Miriam Margolyes is one of the most recognisable figures on stage and screen. She came to Aotearoa in 2012 with her one-woman show Dickens Women. And she's done Hollywood, she's done Call the Midwife, she's done audio porn, everything in between. Her new autobiography, This Much Is True, is a riotous account of her larger-than-life life. She says an early title was too fat to go to bed with. And indeed, it might deserve a PG rating, but it's also, of course, charming and funny and often serious. I caught up with her in Glasgow. She's on a book tour. And I told her that I'd just seen the episode of the show she fronted, the series she fronted, Almost Australian, in which she explored the concept of mateship.
Well, it's a long time since I've seen the programme. And in fact, I don't think I have seen it because I make it a rule not to watch my own programmes.
I know. You haven't even watched Harry Potter.
Well, that's true, yes.
I wanted to ask you how Alice Springs ended up the lesbian capital of the world.
Well, I was hoping you could tell me. I have no idea why that took place. It was fascinating to me because when I had been to Alice Springs before, many years before, that was not at all the case.
I also wanted to ask you about your sense of justice, which is apparent throughout your book and apparent even in that single episode of Almost Australia. You're absolutely outraged at the poverty of the Aboriginals there. And you say it makes the whole mateship thing that Australians make so much of seem very hollow. I wonder if you got much flack from Australians for daring to criticise.
Oh, yes, I certainly did. And I expected it too, because Australians are quite touchy people. They are passionately patriotic and feel that any criticism of Australia is unpatriotic. Well, I'm an Australian now, dual nationality, and my attitude is that criticism makes things better. And if you love a place, and I love Australia, you want to make it better. Therefore, I think criticism is exactly what is needed, just like actors need to be criticised. So do countries, so do governments. And that has always been my position. And I feel that there is a grave lack in Australia of justice towards First Nation people. And I have to speak out against it when I come across it.
Presumably you became Australian because of Heather, your long, long time partner.
Correct.
53 years.
Yes, it's pretty amazing. And of course, I have to admit, as everybody is keen to point out, that we're only still together because we don't live together. That may be true. But now, in our late years, I'm 80, she's 78, we do actually want to live together. And we're trying to find a way because our stupid government in England has invented this absolute catastrophe called Brexit, which is effectively keeping us apart. But I believe that the reason that we've stayed together so long, we're both professional women. We both felt that our work was very important to us. And we decided to follow our careers, but keep our relationship going. And although it's not easy, we managed to do that for 53 years.
When I was reading your book, I kept on thinking, oh no, how would Heather feel you writing that? And you have said that she hasn't read your book, which I think is probably quite a good thing. She would never, for example, she would never wear a gay Yids badge, ever, would she?
She certainly wouldn't. First of all, because she would think it rather poor taste, and also because she's not a Yid. She's a well-brought-up Australian Methodist, I think, although she's, like me, she's an atheist. We're very different characters. She is much more conventional on the outside and better behaved than I am. I have always been a naughty schoolgirl, and I'm afraid even at the age of 80, I have to confess that that element of my character is still in operation. But I don't want Heather to read the book because I think it would offend and disgust her in places. But I have a wider duty to tell the truth. And so that's why some of these rather less appealing episodes of my life have been inserted.
Some of those less appealing episodes in your life, we can't even talk about on national radio. Suffice it to say, you seem to have always been completely uninhibited. Is that true?
I think it is true. I'm not sure quite why, because my parents were conventional, middle-class Jewish people. My father, a GP, trying to make a living in a slightly hostile world. And somehow they gave me the confidence because they loved me so much. And they spoilt me, I have to admit, to behave in a consistently inappropriate way throughout my life. And sometimes I know I'm being naughty, and sometimes I just don't. But I feel I can't censor myself. There's some limiting factor which most people have that I don't seem to have in my makeup. And it has brought me into trouble lots and lots of times. But I'm not going to change now, am I? I'm too old to change now.
Did anybody, your publisher, for example, try to censor any parts of your book? In fact, did any parts get taken out?
Well, some parts didn't get put in, which might surprise you, but
Does.
but no, the publishers made no attempt to censor me. They just said we might have to run that past the lawyers. And I believe there were a team of lawyers who went through my material very carefully. And so far, I haven't been sued. But I mean, in certain instances, I didn't put encounters of a sexual nature because the people were still alive or their spouses were still alive, and it would have been hurtful. And I really don't want to hurt people. That is not what I want to do. And that's why, for a very long time, I resisted the blandishments of other publishers to write a book. But I have to tell you, the honest truth is, I wrote this because they made me an offer I couldn't refuse.
I'm glad to hear it.
Well, when you get old, you think that you're going to need money for carers. And I don't have a lot of cash. I have a lot of property. And if I sold my property, then I would have cash. But I like to have cash. And so this book was going to bring me in some cash. And that meant that I would be able to have carers if I lost the use of my limbs or if I had a stroke like my mother did.
Talking of you very rarely censoring yourself, there was an episode with your mother that you wish you had censored yourself about, and it was when you told her that you were a lesbian. And she took it very badly, and as you say in the book, you should never have told her. You caused the person you loved most in the world a pain she could not bear, and not long thereafter, she had a stroke. And you, in some way, feel guilty about that.
Oh, yes, I do. I regret it with all my heart because I adored my mother. And I knew when I told her that it would upset her. I didn't know that it would have such devastating consequences. But I think the thing is that when you're young and you fall in love and you discover sex, as I did, you want to talk about it. You want to tell people. You feel that that people, have got to listen and understand what's going on. And I think that that is a mistake. There are some people who can't bear certain information, and it's indulgent. So I'm not in agreement with Ian McKellen, for example, who is a great advocate for gays around the world and a very great actor too, and a friend of mine. And he disagrees with me profoundly. and feels that it is incumbent upon everybody to be able to absorb the fact that some people are homosexual. It's not a crime, it's not a sin, according to him. And he feels that gay people should have a right to express and tell people what is happening to them. I don't.
Did it not have a devastating effect on you to find that your mother could not unconditionally love you, knowing that you were a lesbian?
I think the real thing is that she did love me unconditionally, but the love was hurt. It didn't mean that she loved me less. She didn't love me less. But the pain I caused her was what troubled me. I never felt she loved me less. I knew I disappointed her and my father. And that made me sad. It still makes me sad. But there's nothing I can do about it now.
Cambridge was incredibly formative for you. It's where you discovered what you loved, who you loved, you made friends, you have a gift for making and keeping friends, you have intense friendships. But you do say what an unpleasant experience it was in the Footlights with John Cleese and Tim Brooke Taylor and Bill Oddie. You're not the only woman who's disclosed this to me recently, actually. But you say that they evidenced studied cruelty towards you. What did they do?
What they did was they stopped speaking to me during the run of the show so that I would perform with them on stage, and then when we went off into the wings or into the dressing rooms, there was no contact. They didn't look at me, they didn't speak to me. It's what we call, I don't know if you use the expression, sending to Coventry. They sent me to Coventry. I became a non-person. They blinded me. It was at the time incredibly upsetting. It was more hurtful than I can express. And that's why, oh, more than 60 years later, I'm still beefing on about it. A lot of people have said to me, for goodness sake, Miriam, it was a long time ago. Forget it. I can't. And I decided that I would refer to it in my book. Of course, I thought about, should I put this in? Is it going to make me look an idiot? And I thought, you shouldn't care about that. You have to tell the truth. That was my note to myself throughout the entire writing of the book.
One of, or two of the movies that people may remember you best is Mrs. Mingott in Scorsese's Age of Innocence, which you won a BAFTA for, of course, and The Nurse in Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet, two fantastic movies. Did you love doing them, or is it hard doing movies because you can't control the flow?
Oh, wasn't I lucky? Yes, I did love doing them. And it was hard because I wanted to be good. You know, I wanted to be as good as all the other people in the films. And film is not my natural medium, I don't think. Some people, Jeremy Irons, for example, he's a terrific stage actor too, but he's wonderful in film. He knows how to work with the camera. Well, I honestly don't. It's not my skill. What I can do is become another person. And I had terrific directors, Martin Scorsese and Baz Luhrmann, very, very different people, very, very different methods, but the same obsession with their project, the same commitment to all the actors that they work with. And I think I was unbelievably lucky. I know that the studio didn't want me to be the nurse in Romeo and Juliet. They wanted a great actress, Kathy Bates, to play that part. But Baz, bless his heart, he fought for me to play it. And I'm thrilled I did. I think it was a good performance.
You've done things that even your greatest fans might not know about. Sexy Sonia, for example.
I'm shocked that you should bring that up.
Are you?
Well, yes. Well, it's a long time ago. I made an audio sex tape I hasten and insist on saying an audio, not a visual one. It was at the beginning of my voiceover work, and another actress had made a bit of money doing those kind of tapes, and she said, "Do you want to have a go?" So I said, "Oh, yes, okay." So off I went to the Ann Summers sex shop, auditioned for a sleazy man in the warehouse with all those twisted scrotums and, I don't know what to call them, sex toys, although not exactly toys to me, but nipple clamps and so on the walls. And I performed the audition for him, which was entirely vocal, entirely vocal. And then I got the job and I did the tape.
And this was for Men in Raincoats to listen to, was it?
I don't know who listened to it, but it's my understanding that it would have been slightly pervy, sad people who have to have a take-home sex kit and listen in the privacy of their bedrooms. I really don't know, and I haven't heard it for years and years and years. I haven't got a copy anymore, and I'd be very glad if somebody sent me in a copy. I'd love to know what I sounded like.
I'm sure none of our listeners have got a sexy Sonia tape in their back drawer. But you've never, ever come upon anybody who said, "Here, I remember you, you were sexy Sonia."
No, I haven't ever met anybody who would admit to listening to that particular example of my talent.
Was it well remunerated?
Not particularly well remunerated. I got £300 in cash, no repeats.
No, no royalties.
No royalties.
You also dubbed a Japanese action series called Monkey, which I'd never heard of, but it made you a bit of a superstar in some quarters, didn't it?
Yes, it was part of the voice work that every actor gets from time to time, revoicing foreign movies and animation features. And it was incredibly popular in Australia. And all the film crews that I worked with when I work in Australia, when they find out that I was in Monkey, they're just thrilled to bits. That's impressed them more than anything else I've ever done. I'd forgotten it completely, but I played all the female parts, and it was fun to do. I think there was a character called Princess Tiki Haha or Icky Poo Poo or something. I can't remember the name, but I didn't do that one. That was my colleague Elizabeth Proud, who was at Cambridge with me. She was Princess Tippi Kaha, but I did all the other female parts. And it was a big series. I mean, I made quite a bit of money out of that.
Have you ever, since you began, I mean, I know there was a hiatus when you left Cambridge and wondered whether you were going to make it, but once you had started work in acting, have you never stopped? Has there never been a period where you thought, "Oh Lord, where's my next job coming from?"
Not for a very long time. I've been so lucky. I can't quite understand it, and I still can't quite believe it, but I've made a good living in show business for many, many years. And I am, I have to admit, unpromising material. I say it sadly, but it's true. Not a good looking, short, physically in many ways unappealing. And yet I've managed to make a living in this business. I'm deeply grateful for that. And ever surprised, always surprised.
Stephen Fry, your very good friend, says that you're so outrageous and so ostentatiously self-deprecating, you describe yourself as a fat Jewish lesbian with no neck, so that you can retaliate first. What do you make of that?
I think it's probably quite an astute judgment because, as you know, Stephen has a ferocious intellect and a sharp perception. I think what I do is I tell people, "I know all the things you're going to say about me, and they're all true, and they admit it. and I admit it. So now what are you going to do? I think there is an element of that.
But when you were at school, you were very popular. It's not as if you were bullied or unpopular. You were highly popular, but at the same time, frightened of not being popular. Is that still a feeling that you have?
Yes, I think it is. I mean, everybody is a mixture of overconfidence and lack of confidence, and I think I'm just like everybody else. I know when I've done good work and good things, and I honestly believe that I am a nice person. I try to be a loyal friend and a kind person. I really do. I think I behave in a moral fashion, but I do doubt myself quite often, and I think that's important, because if you're just smug all the time, you're a pain in the arse, and I don't want to be that.
I'm talking to Miriam Margolyes, who's just published her autobiography called This Much Is True. Speaking of Stephen Fry, he did the famous runner from a play, probably had a nervous breakdown, he's been quite open about it. You did a runner as well, didn't you?
Yes, I did. I can't say that my runner, as you put it, my running away from a job was because I had a nervous breakdown. And Stephen is subject to depression. He's been very open about that. I'm not. My situation was I'm very critical. And if I think somebody is no good, I'll run. And if it's me and I'm no good, I'll run too. Yes, that was in Snow Wilson's play, Flaming Bodies. I was just nervous. I was frightened of doing the first night. There was a long speech at the beginning, 8 pages of it. And I was frightened I'd forget my lines. And I just thought, I can't go on. I'm no good. And so I got in a taxi and Julie hurried after me to try and get me back. We drove round and round London. I missed the first night, but she made me come back the second night, and I was brilliant.
Any more runners or walk-offs or no-shows you want to get off your chest while we're on the subject?
Maybe there were some things that I should have run away from, but I went on with it.
I don't think so. Do you? Do you think there are some things you should have not done?
I don't think so. Well, not in the acting sphere, but I don't think that I should have allowed the Daily Mail, a newspaper in England, to serialise my book, because they took all the naughty bits and all the gossip and all the negative elements of it and put it in the serialisation, and leaving people with a feeling that I'm a bad-tempered and shockingly behaved human being. And the book has got more to it than that. I hope you will agree.
I do agree. And who on earth advised you to let the Daily Mail serialise it?
My publishers. And they're very good publishers, actually. They published Lord Byron, Charles Darwin and Jane Austen. And they've done a brilliant job with me. They've really guided me and helped me. And they were thinking about the marketing. You know, they were thinking about a newspaper that sells more copies than any other in Britain. And they thought that, well, that's a good start to get Miriam's book on the market. Well, it may have been a good way of bringing it to the attention of the British public, but I was very uneasy about it. And when I saw what they'd done with the serialisation, I was furious, because it's worth more than they allowed it to be in their scurrilous rag.
Just imagine what they would have done with Byron and Darwin and Austen.
Exactly.
Terrible business.
One of the problems with being an artist is that you have to sell your wares, and sometimes it makes you do things you regret.
What was the movie you did with Arnold Schwarzenegger?
It was called End of Days, and it's a rather silly horror fantasy, and I was playing Satan's sister.
I don't know Why, that sounds funny. I've never seen that movie, but Arnold Schwarzenegger is not one of your favorite people.
No, he isn't. I mean, he wasn't horrible. He was just vulgar and crude and farted in my face and groped the other women, not me, I may say. I just thought he was a lout, a thug. But he's not an evil man. He's just terribly silly.
Do you remember? You'll know this because you're familiar with Clive James. You got to know Clive James, I think. He described Arnold Schwarzenegger as having a body like a condom full of walnuts.
Oh, wasn't Clive wonderful? How I miss him.
Yes.
Yes, great writer, delightful companion. Yes, I knew him from the time that he came to England. Well, it's a brilliant description. One of the things that Arnold brought with him was a huge trailer, which was a gym, as well as his own huge trailer. And he had a group of blokes with him, and they used to go in and do whatever blokes do in gyms, tone up. And I mean, it's very sensible to exercise. I know I should have done more, but there's got to be life in the head as well as in the body.
You know these blokes like Schwarzenegger, and you tell another story about Warren Beatty, who insisted on auditioning you for Reds in his Winnebago or whatever you call them, and asked you if you had sex, and so on. Do you think that these type of men have been expunged now, thanks to the Me Too movement?
I hope that they are behaving better, and I think they are. I think men are afraid actually to grope and do the things that they got away with before, and that's a jolly good thing. But not all men are like that. I mean, I'm not a
Not at
man
all.
hater, nor a man despiser. I just think that some men think that they're more attractive than they are, and they just better get used to the fact that we can now say "go away" or words to that effect.
Do you really eat whole onions like apples?
Yes, I do.
Is that a Scottish thing? My mother swore by the benefits of raw onion.
Well, I didn't know that it was a Scottish thing. My father was a Scottish Jew, and I think that it is a Jewish thing. We love onions and garlic. I mean, I eat garlic raw as well, but not often because it has a pungent after effect, and people don't like you if you breathe all over them. But onions, I can't resist, and particularly in the morning with cheese. I like melted cheese and a raw onion. It's the most delicious thing, and I really recommend it.
I don't want to get too personal here, but do you think that the onions might be responsible for your self-confessed and somewhat famous flatulence?
There's no way of knowing, is there? I don't know.
Not unless
I'm
you
not
stop
the.
eating them.
That would be impossible. I'm sure that other people in the world express wind from the nether regions, but maybe they don't do it as openly as I do. I don't like keeping things in, either from my
No,
mouth or the other end.
apparently not. You got an OBE in 2002, and something, there was a lovely bit in your book, some thought that because of your political views, you shouldn't have accepted it. And you wrote, "Of course I shouldn't have. It goes against everything I believe in, but I most certainly wasn't going to turn it down." And I just love that kind of attitude, really. You should have rejected it, but no way you wanted to go and get it.
It was a thrill. It was an honor, something I never thought I'd ever have. And when I opened the envelope and it told me that I'd been awarded an OBE and did I want it, I knew that I should have said no, but I wanted it, so I got it.
You've mixed and mingled with the royals quite a bit, really. There's an account of a weekend, I think, in Sandringham with Prince Charles and Camilla, with a whole bunch of writers and actors and luminaries. And Prince Charles showed you an extraordinary thing that his great-great-grandfather used when he had house parties. Can you tell me what that was?
It was a most wonderful weekend. And I really like Prince Charles and Camilla. And I think what people think of them from the newspapers, what they glean, is quite wrong. They are delightful, intelligent and honourable people. And when I arrived at Sandringham, which was really one of the thrills of my life to be invited to that, Prince Charles took me by the hand and guided me to this curious object, which was in the hallway of Sandringham. It looked like a rather wobbly sofa made of leather, a big, big armchair. And he said, do you know what that is? Can you guess? And I said, no. It looks like a sofa. And he said, well, it's actually a weighing machine. And my great-great-grandfather, Prince Edward, King Edward, when guests came to Sandringham, he would ask them to sit in it, and he would weigh them. And he would weigh them again on their exit when they left. And if they hadn't put on weight, he thought he'd been a bad host. And I laughed. And I said, well, I hope, sir, that you're not going to weigh me. But that was absolutely true. And he showed me the weigh-in book with all these incredibly famous people and prime ministers and so on who'd been guests of Edward VII. And their weight was listed on arrival and on departure. I thought it was absolutely extraordinary and delightful.
You have got more political as you've aged. You have not mellowed, but billowed, as you put it, which is the opposite of what tends to happen, isn't it?
Yes, I suppose it is. But I just feel passionately about justice and equality and decency and giving people, as the Australians say, a fair go. And I don't think people are open to giving people a fair go anymore. And it worries me. I don't like it. So I speak out about it. And I tend to mouth off probably too much. People who are Jewish are not happy about my espousal of the Palestinian cause. And that has brought a lot of pain and discord in my life, in my family. But if I see something wrong, I have to speak out against it. And there seems to me to be more and more wrong decisions taken by governments around the world, more corruption. And I have to say it. I have to speak out against it. And I'm an old liberal, darling. That's who I am. And I've stayed that way. And I'm glad that I haven't lost my fire.
But you weren't brought up as a liberal. You were brought up in quite a conservative household. I mean, your mother was a remarkable character, but generally conservative. I don't think they ever voted anything but Tory. When did you discover that you did not agree with that?
You're right in your assessment of my parents. They were passionate and convinced and loyal members of I don't think they joined the Tory party, but they always voted Tory. It was when I met the Hodgkin family. I was radicalised. They're a very great English intellectual family. Dorothy Hodgkin, first female Nobel Prize winner in chemistry for England, a very great scientist. Her daughter was at school with me. One of my greatest and most dear friends in my life, Elizabeth. And I used to go back to their house after school, and from them, because her parents were at one time members of the Communist Party, they left in 57, but they were communists, and I saw another way of being, I saw another way of thinking, another way of realising what happens to people in the world. And that turned me from being a conservative, which I stood as conservative candidate for my school, Oxford High School. But I then became member of, the socialists. And at one time I joined an extreme Trotskyite party called the Workers' Revolutionary Party, which I don't belong to anymore. But it was the Hodgkins who showed me that poverty existed in England and that it was in the fabric of British political life, that people at the bottom end of the scale didn't get a fair suck of the sauce bottle. And I want to give everybody a fair suck of the sauce bottle.
You know, they say in Australia, fair suck of the salve, don't you?
No, I didn't. I didn't know that.
You'll have to amend that if you want to be a real Australian. A fair suck of the salve.
Well, I certainly will. I've never heard that expression.
Have you?
I've got a lot to learn. I've got a lot to learn if I'm going to be a good Australian.
You're espousal of the Palestinian cause I'm interested in because you are also acutely aware of the existence of anti-Semitism, obviously. And I suspect that when you described your father as trying to make his way in a slightly hostile society, that might be what you're referring to. So did you ever hesitate to speak out about the plight of the Palestinians, lest you be seen as disloyal?
I've never hesitated to speak out about the plight of the Palestinians once I had seen it for myself. I went to Gaza many years ago, and I've been to the West Bank several times. And when you see the treatment of Palestinians and the way that their life is curtailed, you cannot help but burn with a sense of anger and injustice. I've seen it. It's not that I listened to other people telling me about it. I saw it. And it hurt me. It shocked me that my own people, I'm so proud of being Jewish. I'm so proud of the compassion that we have shown and the heritage of intelligence and hard work. To think that we, the abused, have become the abusers, it is a terrible thing to me. And I will continue to speak out against it, although I know that even those dear to me, my dear cousin, for example, in Remerera, Carol Blyer, she is shocked and disgusted by my attitude, although I know she loves me. But I can't stop. I can't help it.
What did you see in, where did you go, the Gaza Strip?
Yes, I saw the poverty that people were living in. It's like a prison. It's huge. And people are crushed up against each other. I saw children without shoes. I saw Palestinians being shoved off the pathway. This was in Hebron, not in the Gaza Strip later. When the Jews came out of the synagogue and they pushed people into the gutter, really. I couldn't believe it. I saw people being interrogated, and I was interrogated myself, actually, and I can't say that they were cruel, but they were frightening. It was a frightening experience. It's just something inhuman. Everybody that the Palestinians see is wearing a helmet or carrying a gun. They don't know the real Israelis. They don't know. It's a society that's cut off. I'm incoherent when I talk about it, and I shouldn't be. I should be more cool. But it fires me up, you see, because I don't want my people, my Jewish people that I'm so proud of their history and culture, I don't want them to descend to this cruelty and violence. It's wicked, and I have to speak out against it.
Do you ever think about hosting, I call it a chat show, call it what you like, but you do a lot of Graham Norton, for example. You could do that. You could be in the host chair, couldn't you?
I'm not interested in talking to celebrities. I like doing the documentaries I do because I get to talk to real people. and learn about other people's lives. That's what interests me. I don't want to just gossip or even just chat with people because they're on television and have done things. That it just doesn't interest me. You won't be surprised to hear I've been offered many times to have a chat show, and I've always refused, and I would continue to refuse. I love to talk. I don't want to chat.
I think that's good because watching the Almost Australian series, it's remarkable how many people you are able to chat with and let them talk.
I hope that I listen because they are the people that have to be given voice to, not me. The important thing is, I think I have something in my character which gives people the confidence to talk, and I must listen. And I learnt during doing these documentaries that that was the key, that it's not me people want to hear, it's the people I talk to. So that's what I enjoy, and I'm going to do another series of documentaries, going to Western Australia, South Australia, Tasmania, and hopefully one day even maybe New Zealand.
Whenever we're able to get out and in of New Zealand again, look forward to that. You're working with Andy McDowell on a movie at the moment, though, aren't you, or recently?
Yes, I just finished a movie called My Happy Ending about cancer. It's quite a hard-hitting piece. I love doing it. It was shot in Wales with a largely female cast, and it's a lovely movie, and it'll be out, I suppose, next year. My Happy Ending.
You write that you are a more serious person than people give you credit for, and it seems to me that that's true. And I want you to explain to me why the literary critic Frank Leavis, to whom you grew quite close when you were at Cambridge, was so controversial that he was virtually ostracized by the literary academic community.
I was very privileged to have been taught by Dr. Leavis and his wife Queenie in the 60s. And those people who were taught by him adored him and loved him and saw him as a great teacher and a great moralist. And those who didn't know him personally were put off by him. He was very sure that he was right. He made no concession to anybody who disagreed with him. He was caustic. He didn't try to make friends. He was an austere, separate kind of person. And he suffered because of it. He could make very cutting remarks about colleagues. And he was probably quite loathed by his contemporaries. But I and many others who were taught by him, many students, we adored and admired him, and his teachings resonate with me still and have given me the way of looking at English literature, which I value and continue. But he was not someone who made friends. He didn't try to charm anybody. He wasn't a talker. He was a reserved, icy person of great humanity and great wisdom. I think one of the greatest people I ever met in my life. He was a magnificent person, but he could be incredibly cruel in his criticisms of others, and they didn't like it. And I recount in my book an occasion which was when Lady Lee became the head of Corpus's wife. Corpus Christi College in Cambridge. She gave a party for the entire faculty of Cambridge. And when Leavis walked into the room with his wife, everybody else walked out, and the two of them were left alone. She said it was the most shocking single example of cruelty that she had ever experienced. And I think it was, and it was deliberate. He was loathed by his colleagues, but to us, his students, he was adored.
Was Leavis disliked because of his autocratic demeanour or because of his literary theories?
I'm sure it was a mixture of the two, but mostly because of his autocratic behaviour with other members of the faculty. He could be extremely cutting, and he was publicly cutting in his lectures about his colleagues. And they didn't like it, and they showed it in a very nasty way. In fact, Cambridge English department was riven with nastiness when I was there in the 60s. And it's a great pity because scholarship shouldn't be like that. But they were far nastier to each other than any actor would be. So my memories of those days are of quarrels and vituperation, as well as the insights that I got.
One of the feelings I got from your book was that you wanted to pay tribute to a lot of people that you have loved very much and who've now died. Because, as you say, you're 80, these things happen. I felt quite sad in parts that so many people that you were so close to have now gone.
It's one of the facts of life that people die and you lose friends as you get older and more friends as you get older and older. And I have been lucky in my life to have made many friends, and every single one of them I love and they matter to me. And when they die, I feel as if a bit of me has been cut out, and it's painful. Grief continues. And people like, for example, Sonia, who was such a wonderful director, such a great collaborator. It's not to say we didn't have quarrels, but because I'm quite contentious too, but I have had the joy of friendship, and the price of love is grief when they die.
It's lovely talking to you. You've had a hell of a life, haven't you?
Yes, I have. I kind of didn't realise it until I started to write about it. Because when you're living your life, you just get on with it and get up and do whatever's necessary. And I must say, I'm busier now than I've ever been in my entire life. And I'm jolly lucky that that's the case.
How on earth did you remember everything that's in the book?
Well, some of the things I just remembered because they were important to me and I retained them. And I talked to a lot of the people that I reference in my book, and they reminded me of things that I had forgotten. Many people all the time are telling me about things I've said and done that I've completely forgotten. And sometimes I'm very glad that I have, because I've been very rude and I've said rather shocking and... Well, you know, I mean, as you know, you can't talk about some of the things in the book that I've done and said. But yes, I've had a hell of a life. It's true.
It's been great talking to you. I'll let you go and have breakfast now, Miriam Margolyes.
Well, what a pleasure to talk to you. And thank you very much for having me on the programme.
It was Miriam Margolyes, whose autobiography is called This Much Is True.